Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome. Nearly one out of every 133 Americans suffers from an autoimmune disorder known as celiac disease. The research indicates that celiac disease is actually twice as common as Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, and cystic fibrosis combined. Left untreated, it can be life-threatening, but a very simple dietary change can help most people live a normal, active life. And you know what? It was really interesting when I was doing my research for this segment because I was shocked by how many different symptoms people had. There was no one particular symptom. One woman went to many doctors who told her she was depressed. For years, they told her she was depressed. And she eventually started going to a doctor every day saying, I'm sick, there's something wrong. And finally, one doctor did a test for celiac disease. And she's now been in remission for 9 years. So coming up around 12:30, we'll talk with an international leading researcher about this disease, Dr. Alessio Fasano. He's with the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and he's also the founding director of the Center for Celiac Disease Research. He'll be sharing the latest findings, what we need to know, and most importantly, how to live well with celiac disease. First, I'm very pleased to welcome Seattle mystery author J.A. Jantz to the show. She's the New York Times bestselling author of the J.P. Beaumont series, the Ali Reynolds series, and three previous Walker family thrillers. The fourth is now out. The fourth in the Walker family series came out just a week or so ago. The new book is called Queen of the Night. J.A. Jantz, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, I say Seattle mystery author. You weren't actually born here, but you've made this your home for much of the year. I guess you duck out during the winter, right?
Seattle is my literary home because it was when I first came to Seattle in 1981 that I finally gave myself permission to start writing my book. So as far as my books are concerned, Seattle is home.
Very good. And I want to share a little bit of that journey with our listeners today before we get there. I spent a very leisurely Saturday, I have to say, reading your latest book. I did enjoy it. But your personal journey itself is very inspiring. And I thought when I was putting my notes together today, J.A., for the show, I thought, now here's a woman who's living her dream. You knew in second grade that you wanted to be a writer. It's now 42 books later, a 43rd is in the works. And yet when you were in college, you were refused admission to the creative writing program, not because of lack of talent. Tell a little about that story, if you would.
Well, I wanted to be a writer, so when I went to the University of Arizona, I signed up to be an English major. When it was time for me to take those upper division courses, I tried to get into the creative writing class, and the professor said, "You're a girl." And I said, "So?" I mean, I already knew I was a girl.
I was going to say, was that a surprise?
Not news to me. He said, "Girls become teachers or nurses. Boys become writers." So I kind of took that to be the gospel at that point, and I did become a teacher. I later became a librarian. I spent 18 years of my life with a man who was allowed in the creative writing program that was closed to me, but he never had anything published. He did tell me at one point, though, that there was only going to be one writer in our family, and he was it. So I didn't actually start writing my first novel until after I divorced him. I had moved to Seattle with my two little kids. I had a full-time job selling life insurance, and I wrote every morning from 4 a.m. to 7 a.m. before I got the kids dressed to go to school and got me dressed to go to work.
That is determination.
Now, I do carry a grudge, however, and that's why the crazed killer in who turns up first in Hour of the Hunter, again, in Queen of the Night, is a former professor of creative writing from the University of Arizona.
You based it on the guy who said, no, you can't come into the program.
Well, actually, I'm really lucky that he didn't let me into the program because he was predisposed that I would fail that class. And if I had failed the creative writing class, I don't think I would have had nerve enough to try.
Mm. You say that that book actually is your, still your favorite one today. Why? Is it because of that?
Well, it's because so much of my own personal life is hidden away in the background of that story. In 1970, my first husband and I spent 60 days being stalked by a serial killer. And I didn't use the real killer in that book because real killers affect real people. But I was able to take what I had learned during that time about what it felt like to have somebody like that after you, and also what I learned during that time of the detective and the homicide investigation that was going on around us to create the background for those books. We spent 60 days being stalked by men who killed people at 20 minutes after 2 on the 22nd day of the month.
Wow. Scary.
And during that time, the detective advised us to leave, but we were young and stupid, so what we did is we armed ourselves. I strapped a loaded revolver on my hip, and I was fully prepared to use it regardless of the consequences. And I think if you'd once made that decision, you have changed something in your very soul.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I never had to pull the trigger, they arrested him before he turned up at our house. They arrested him on the 20th of July, and he had expected us to be the 22nd of July.
Mm.
They arrested him, and so I never had to pull the trigger. But I think that makes it possible for me to understand what law enforcement officers go through each time they put on their weapon, their uniform, and strap on their weapon.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you actually wrote about that story, but it was turned down to begin with because editors said,
yeah.
It's too far-fetched. This would never happen in real life. And
yes,
they say there's nothing stranger.
The stuff that was fiction was fine, and the stuff that was real was unbelievable and would never happen, even though it already had.
So, but anyway, you eventually did get it published. Of all the series that you have, and I mentioned them at the beginning, the J.P. Beaumont series, the Ali Reynolds series, the Walker
Joanna
Fund.
Brady. Yeah.
Yeah, Joanna Brady. Do you have a favorite series, favorite character?
My favorite series is always the one I'm supposed to write about next.
Well, that's good. That gives you incentive, right?
The characters are sort of like literary children, and you don't ask a mother of your kids which is your favorite. So I don't really have a favorite. It's always fun to go back to characters I've been away from for a while to find out what they've been doing in the meantime.
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes it fun for me. There are people you only hear from once a year in a Christmas card, and you want to know what those people have been doing, but you don't see them every day, and that's what my characters are like.
So what is it like for you, J.A.? Do you kind of just literally put them away, and then when you have to write the next book about this particular series of characters, do you bring them out and kind of, you know, greet them again and say, what's been going on? Do you...
That's exactly what I do. I was writing the fifth Joanna Brady book when I suddenly discovered that her mother, in the meantime, had eloped with the medical examiner. And that was
okay.
I practically fell away from my computer when I found that out, just like Joanna almost wrecked her car. But yes, it's always a surprise. In Fire and Ice, when I went back to Beaumont, and Beaumont has sort of a curmudgeonly view of the world. And so when I met up with him in Fire and Ice, and he was this guy who has always been seasick at the very sight of water has just staggered off the teacups in Disneyland because his granddaughter wanted him to go. And the nurse in the infirmary says, "Why did you do that?" It made me laugh because, of course, grandfathers do stupid things when their grandkids ask them.
Right, right. Right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk about your new book a little and share some of that with our listeners. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is prolific author J.A. Jantz. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Intuitive dream coach Joyce Chapman says there are no little dreams, that every desire is important, and that you deserve life to its fullest. As a dream activist, Joyce has helped thousands of people gain clarity about their lives and make positive changes. She can help you too. See more information at joycechapman.com. And if you have a question for Joyce regarding your dream, email joyce@joycechapman.com.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
Following the herd is fine until they lead you off a cliff. Think for yourself. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. I wondered why you were playing that music, Eric, and then I heard the Queen of the Night.
There you go.
Good choice. Thank you. I am, of course, talking in this segment with J.A. Jantz, a New York Times bestselling author of the Joanna Brady series, the J.P. Beaumont series, the Ali Reynolds series, and the Walker Family series. And she's just come out with a new book in the Walker Family series. It's called Queen of the Night. J.A., I spent a very leisurely Saturday, as I said, reading this book. I enjoyed it. Tell us a little about it in your own words.
In the Walker books, I use pieces of Tohono O'odham legends, which I learned as a storyteller during the 5 years I was a librarian on the reservation. And so every book has had some of those legends mixed into it. The legend in this book that's integral to the story is the story of an old woman who goes to Mexico to rescue her grandson when her daughter is dying. And when she comes back carrying him in her burden basket, she is greeted by E.E. Toy, who is the Tohono O'odham's spirit of goodness or elder brother. He takes the baby the rest of the way home, and then he says, "Give me your baby. I'll take him. You sit down here and rest, and while you're resting, your feet will turn into roots, your body will turn into branches, and once a year, you will be the most beautiful plant on earth, the queen of the night-blooming cirrus." So that's where the legend ends. But it occurred to me that if old white-haired woman had brought this baby back, then somewhere there must be a brought-back child. And so this is a story of a number of brought-back children. Dan Pardee, who was taken by a police officer from the blood-spattered living room where his mother was murdered. Lonnie Walker, who was abandoned by her birth parents when she survives being bitten by countless ants. And Brian Fellows. Brian Fellows, you meet in the first Walker book, Hour of the Hunter. He's the son of Brandon Walker's first wife. So he has no real relationship. He's not a blood relation to Brandon Walker. But in Hour of the Hunter, Brandon Walker goes to pick up his two sons for custodial, non-custodial parent visits. And here's this, their half-brother, their little half-brother, Brian Fellows, left alone. His father never comes. And so finally, Brandon Walker takes pity on Brian and starts taking him with his two boys. And so this lifelong relationship between Brian Fellows and Brandon Walker is born. So Brian isn't really a family member, but yes, he is part of the Walker family.
Yeah. It's very intricate weaving of plot in the first part of the book. You've got all these characters in separate places, separate times, doing different things, and you just know they're all going to come together at some point in the book. Or their
It's sort of like creating a story than as opposed to telling it.
Yes. Now, I was reading it as I was reading that. I thought, I wonder if did you begin with the end in mind on that to keep all of that straight?
Never.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
I hated outlining when I first met it in sixth grade geography. So I start at the beginning and right to the end. And the way you read the book is exactly the way I wrote it.
Wow, that is interesting. That's a miracle that it came together. I mean, that shows your storytelling powers there.
See, I've had two people who have written it. The book is told through multiple points of view, over multiple timelines, and the changes of point of view are set off by those time, place, and weather stamps throughout the book. Two people have written to me and said, you know, toward the end of the book, you must have gotten too excited because you use the same pieces of dialogue exactly, word for word, just a couple pages apart. Are you becoming a lazy writer? And I had to write back to them and explain. At that point, two of the characters and two of the points of view are riding in the same vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, you're hearing the same dialogue, but those two characters have different reactions to those same words and different consequences.
Yeah, I actually picked up on that. I did pick up on that. I really liked this. I want to just read this out to our listeners. You say on your website there's a song by Iris DeMent that speaks to what writers do. Sweet is the melody, so hard to come by, so hard to make.
So hard to make all the words sound just right. You lay down the hours without a trace till a tune for the dancing is there in its place.
Mm.
And that's exactly what writers do, too. There's a lot of typing involved in writing a book, but there are countless hours of playing solitaire when I have no idea what's going to happen next.
That's just called letting the creative stream brew, right?
Exactly.
So you say it takes, generally it takes you about 600 hours to write a book, and 300 hours of those are thinking and 300 are actually typing.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Interesting. Who have been your biggest influences, J.A.?
I'm sorry?
Who have been your biggest influences from a writing point of view?
Well, the first would have been Carolyn Keene, who wrote the Nancy Drew books. I read the Nancy Drew. Well, I know that Carolyn Keene was a pseudonym for the lady who wrote all the Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys and Dana Girls. But I loved those mysteries as a kid. As a young adult, I started reading the John D. McDonald books, the Travis McGee books.
Mm-hmm.
And it was reading those that caused me to understand that you could write an ongoing series for adults.
Mm. Now, I know you're on book tour right now, and I was reading through your blog, and I enjoyed reading your blog as much as I enjoyed reading your book. And you talk on there about book tours, and I think that's something that people don't get how much goes into going on a book tour. This time you chose to drive. Tell us why.
Well, I drove because I didn't lose you, did I?
No, we're here.
Oh, okay. I just punched a button on my phone inadvertently.
Oh, that's okay. We're still here.
It's hard to go to second-tier cities on tour because commercial air travel makes that impossible. You have to go through hub cities. So, for instance, to get from Denver to Albuquerque is a 5.5-hour drive, but it's an 8-hour flight because you have to fly from Denver to Dallas or Denver to Salt Lake and then change planes and go to Albuquerque.
Mm-hmm.
The publicists like to send people, authors, to places that are easy to get to by air. And so I've gone to what are sort of second-tier cities, but we've had 200 and 300 people at events because authors seldom come there.
Right.
And there's been real excitement and really fun events and rewarding events. And tours are about me going out and telling some of the stories behind the various books. But it's also a chance for me to hear other people's stories. For instance, the other night in Flagstaff, there was an Indian man, a Native American man, standing in line. He said, his wife is a big fan of mine. She's in the hospital battling breast cancer, and he was going to take that book to the hospital and read it aloud to her.
Mm.
Well, did that give you goosebumps? It gave me goosebumps when
yeah.
he said it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I love that you are so accessible, and you say you answer all of your own email, which is admirable, because I'm sure you get a lot. I know you've got a new book coming out in the summer of 2011. It's off in editing right now. But talk about tell us what you call your writing bubble, because I was, again, impressed with this. You needed so little to actually sit down and write, and you've written 42 books.
Well, somebody asked me, would I please send them a photo of my office. What office? I don't have an office. I use a laptop. And I sit on a chair in Washington, in Bellevue, Washington, in our home there. I sit on a chair in the family room. And in Tucson, in our home there, I sit on a chair in the family room. And I don't look at a view, because if I looked at a view, I wouldn't be working.
Right. I can relate to that. And that's it. You just sit down and you just get in that zone and right away. I can just picture you there now.
Well, and I lose track of day it actually is in real life, because a lot of times I'll be involved in the day it is in the book.
Mm.
And I'll surface and I'll think it's the weekend and it's actually not the weekend, because it's only the weekend in the book I'm writing.
Right. So the book you're writing on now, is that, I think I remember that was a Beaumont series book coming out, and it's
yes,
number 20?
The next 20? Book due out in the 4th of February will be the next Ellie Reynolds book, Fatal Error. And the next Beaumont book is written and due out next July, but so far my editor and I have not agreed on a name for that baby, so... It's Beaumont 20, but we don't know what its name is yet.
Okay, well, I guess that's going to come to you in just like your characters come to you. We're almost at the end of the segment. I know I have to let you go. You're very busy, and I want to make sure that we get out all of the Washington area events, because I know you've done some already. But I'll let listeners know that you'll be in Marysville on Thursday, August 12th at 12 p.m. at Fred Meyer. You'll be in Kirkland on Thursday, August 12th at 4:30 at Costco. You're in Fort Lewis, Washington on Friday, August 13th at 11:30.
That one, in order to get on base for that, you have to have someone in the vehicle with military ID.
Okay, good to know. And then the Port Angeles one is on Friday, August 13th at 7 p.m. That's at Port Book and News, Port Angeles Public Library. There's one in Silverdale on Saturday, August 14th at 12, Barnes & Noble, and one in Bellingham on Sunday, August 15th at 12:30. I'm sure you've got
actually,
all these.
Actually, 5 p.m. on that the dam in Silverdale. I believe that there is a signing for Founders Day in the Denny Regrade in Belltown.
Oh, okay.
And so for information on that, they can call and get information from the bookseller, Seattle Mystery Bookshop, or I believe it'll be posted on my website.
Okay, super. And your website is simply jajance.com, correct?
That's it.
Yeah. Well, I thank you so much for being with us. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with before you go, J.A.?
Somebody asked me last week what was my favorite part about Seattle, and I said July. But I think I'd have to make an exception for this July.
Well, <it's, laughs> I enjoyed talking with you, and I hope to see you at one of the book signings. Good luck.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye. And my guest again, J.A. Jance, and you can check out her website at jajance.com for a list of all of the book signings that she's doing in this area. Please do stay with us. We're talking with Dr. Alessio Fasano coming up next. He's an expert on celiac disease. He's going to reveal all to us in just a few moments. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick and Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time. Thanks for joining us on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. If you have comments or questions on any of our shows, we want to hear from you. Email info@conversationslive.net. Call Vicki toll-free at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Or leave a message at our special listener voicemail box, 206-414-6159. That's 206-414-6159.
More choices, more topics, more shows. One station. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. Welcome back. We're talking in this segment about celiac disease, and we have with us one of America's leading experts on this subject, Dr. Alessio Fasano. Dropped all my papers here. Here we are. I want to tell you a little bit about Dr. Alessio Fasano. He is the director of the Mucosal Biology Research Center, the director of the Center for Celiac Research. He is a professor of pediatrics, physiology, and medicine at University of Maryland School of Medicine. And he's written a great book with a couple of other doctors, Jeffrey Holmes and Carlo Cattasi, called Fast Facts, Celiac Disease. And he really is a leading expert in this topic. So, Dr. Alessio Fasano, welcome to the show today.
Thank you, Vicki. It's my pleasure.
Well, I'm so glad we could get hold of you and have you here because I read that one in 133 people have, or Americans have, celiac disease. But I wanted to go back just a little bit to the beginning. You were a pediatric doctor in Italy, as I understand it, and you wanted to come to America and find out how come so many people in Italy were suffering with celiac disease and so few in America were. But when you got here, you found out we really didn't know very much about it. So I wonder if you'd share that story with us.
Sure. The real story, not the sanitated one, is that the reason why I accept the job to come on this other side of the pond is because I was sick and tired to deal with celiac disease. That was the only thing that I was dealing with, or mainly, when I was at the School of Medicine in Naples. And, you know, I knew that the disease was rare here, so I said, you know, gee, a little bit of variety, and then I accept the job. And my prediction was, well, maybe that I will see a few cases here and there every year. So weeks passed by, months passed by, and I didn't see a single one. So my first publication on celiac disease when I moved here was a review paper, in which I asked myself, where all the American celiacs gone? Because there were none. So that's how the journey started. And in dig into the reason why the disease was rare here, I came to the conclusion that there were only two possible scenarios. Either it was extremely rare for real, mm-hmm. meaning that despite the two ingredients of the recipe necessary for developing celiac disease, i.e. the genes and the exposure to grains, they were here because, you know, our ancestor came from Europe. We eat the same grain that they eat on this other side. Granted, you know, the pasta in Italy is better than the pasta we have here, but, you know, grains are grains.
Right.
And yet the disease would not be here, so it's something very exciting to can explain why this was not happening. Or the second scenario that turns to be the real one is that the disease was not rare but was overlooked.
Mm. And even today, I was surprised when I was doing my research, it is still overlooked in many cases or misdiagnosed.
Well, the reason why is because we've been taught about celiac disease in classical terms. You know, if you have been in the medical school a while ago, that will tell you, one, is a pediatric condition, i.e. only kids. Two, is a gastrointestinal disorder, i.e. you have only GI symptoms. Three, in general, you have diarrhea and you lose weight because of that. And if you think this is the paradigm of celiac disease, it is true that you almost see nobody here in the United States and Canada with this kind of traits. And then over the years, we learned that celiac disease was much more than that. One, it's not a pediatric condition, but it's no age is spared. Two, that it's not just a gastrointestinal, you know, condition, because every single organ or tissue in our body can be affected. And three, it's not just diarrhea. You can be constipated and have celiac disease. So that is the reason why, you know, the level of awareness was so, so low.
Right. And I just want to refer to this. There was an article that you were involved in a bulletin, medical bulletin, and there was a woman in there named Anne Whelan who had symptoms that her doctors could not diagnose. They kept telling her that she was depressed. She had palpitations. She did have gastrointestinal problems, but she also had shooting bone pain, muscle pain, and unbearable crushing fatigue. She also says she had severe memory problems that affected her life and her job. And yet nobody tested for celiac disease, and they kept treating her for depression until she finally went back one day and said, look, I'm sick. And finally they ran a celiac disease test. In fact, she was told by a couple of people that only kids, as you said, get celiac disease.
Yeah. And it's the classical paradigm, so what can go wrong? And everything went wrong with her. First of all, she was affected by the most frequent symptom with which this celiac disease presents itself nowadays, i.e. anemia. It's the most frequent way that disease presents itself in adults right now. With anemia comes fatigue, and meaning that, you know, you don't have enough, red cells that to shuffle around oxygen, and therefore you can use, you know, your calories the right way. So you become chronically fatigued. And of course, you can't think straight when you're tired. This happened to all of us. And therefore, you start to have problems in terms of memory. And when you start to see that you are deteriorating and you shop from one doctor to another, I challenge anybody to keep your composure straight. You start to be depressed because you say, gee, I'm falling apart and nobody can tell me what's wrong with me. And then when she kept going back to the doctor, because definitely she didn't feel well, and the doctor said, start to say, look, everything is in your mind. In other words, not only you're depressed, you're crazy. Mm. And, you know, and that's the way that has to be. So she really thought that it was the end of her road, because she saw herself to, you know, slowly but surely consuming, you know, her own energy to the point in which she was not functional.
Right, right. And I know she said at the end she just literally couldn't get out of bed because her hurt too much to put her feet on the ground.
That's right.
So let's get to the obvious question then. And what exactly is celiac disease?
Let me answer by saying what is not. Because until the recent past, beside the other misconceptions that I told you before, we thought there was a food allergy. It is not. It's truly an autoimmune disease. In other words, it's like having, you know, diabetes, multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis. This implies three things. One, as I mentioned before, this recipe requires two ingredients. Genes, many, that you're born with, and the exposure to a trigger that your immune system is not able to handle correctly because of your genetic makeup. Immune system is there to defend you against the attackers. And, you know, when you are exposed to it, you know, they get rid of it. In people without immunity, the exposure to attacker actually induces an immune response that starts to attack your own body. The target is the brain, and you develop MS. The target is the pancreas, and you develop diabetes. The joint, you develop the rheumatoid arthritis. The guts, you develop celiac disease. So that's number one. Number two, because it's an autoimmune disease, you're not going to grow out of it. So in other words, once you got it, you enjoy it for the rest of your life. So there is no way that will go away,
right,
contrary with food allergies. The third thing that is important is the only autoimmune disease for which there is a treatment. Not a cure, but a treatment. Because it's the only autoimmune disease for which we know the trigger. That is this strange protein gluten that's present in certain grains. The treatment is to avoid gluten at all costs and 100% and forever. When you eliminate one of the two ingredients in the recipe, the immune system has no enemy to fight and will shut down. Will remember forever the enemy, but will not fight the war unless this enemy, i.e. gluten, comes again into the picture, i.e. you eat gluten again.
Right.
So once you go on a gluten-free diet, unless you've been causing irreparable and irreversible, you know, damage, everything goes back to normal, everything.
Now, the intestines, as I understand it, are an organ. It renews itself every 3 days. So is it possible to do irreparable damage to the villi, like the little fingers? You can describe it much better than me.
Yeah.
Is it possible to do permanent damage?
That's right. The general conception of what the intestine is and does for living, it's one single magic to transform food in poop. It does much more than that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the largest interface with the environment. So it's exposed to the harshest stimuli that you can imagine. Through the GI tracts, besides friends, i.e. nutrients, become foes, enemies. So it's a wealth of bacteria and viruses that come through. Chemicals that we don't want in our body. Pollutants that if they come through will be out of commission. So the intestine, in other words, he's really exposed to one of the harshest environments that you can imagine. And therefore, not only is the largest interface with the environment, but has to create that strong barrier to prevent to have these enemies to come through without control. This barrier is made by a single layer of cells. That's all. They are really tightly interconnected with each other and form this formidable barrier from the mouth all the way down. We're talking about 20 feet. And therefore, these are the cells that cover all the surface of the intestine, including this finger-like protrusion that you were named as villi. To avoid that anything goes wrong just because you are exposed to such harsh environment, Mother Nature arrange the villi and therefore the cells that cover the villi in a very sophisticated way. These villi are kind of hills, and in between villas there are these valleys. At the bottom of these valleys, there are what we call the stem cells, i.e. the cells that can reproduce themselves to become mature cells that cover the villi. These cells, they start maturation at a very specific rhythm so that they start from the bottom and they travel toward the top of the villi so that you change the entire lineage of villi every 3-5 days. So no matter how old are you, your guts are always 3 to 5 days old.
That's so interesting.
And the destiny of these cells, it's fascinating. It's the same story of the caterpillar, the butterfly. When they are stem cells, they are unsophisticated. They are, you know, ugly to look at. They don't know how to do the job right. Then a biological clock say, it's time for you to mature and then start to go on the top of the villi. This journey takes these 3-5 days. By the time that you reach the top, you are one of the most sophisticated cells in the body, i.e. you're a butterfly. But your life is only a few hours, and then you fell off. So when you have an insult like celiac disease, rather than to change the line of the cells every 3-5 days, you destroy the cells much more faster. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you have to change this every 24 or 36 hours to keep up with the rate of destruction. And therefore, this villi will get shorter and shorter, and these butterflies would not come about because they will stay all caterpillars. So these are cells that are not able to digest and absorb right the foodstuff. They do not have all the sophisticated machinery to do their job right, and that's the reason why you pay a price.
Okay, because it hasn't had a chance to form properly. Interesting.
That's
interesting.
Right.
We need to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to ask you about definitive tests for celiac disease. I have a couple of listener questions as well. We're talking with Dr. Alessio Fasano. We're talking about celiac disease. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to help you heal and stay healthy.
1150kknw.com. Your connection to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Dr. Alessio Fasano. He is the director of the Center for Celiac Research, a professor of pediatrics, physiology and medicine at University of Maryland School of Medicine. And we're talking about celiac disease. I wanted to ask you, because I had a couple of listener questions, Dr. Fasano. I had a listener in Fremont who was diagnosed. She has celiac disease. She's in her 30s. She's 8 months pregnant. She's heard it can be hereditary and that it affects children differently. What are some of the signs she should look for in a newborn? Is there anything obvious that she should look for?
None. By definition, you know, assuming that her new baby will be unlucky enough to have the same genes that mom has to develop celiac disease, he or she does not have the second element, i.e. gluten. Until gluten is introduced in the diet, celiac disease cannot come about.
Okay.
And the other thing that I want to say, just to make clear, that we're not talking about high frequency here, you know, if you are Joe Smoe out there, you have 1% roughly, you mentioned 1 in 133, but let's say for the sake of discussion, 1% chance that you develop celiac disease. The listening baby, because mom has celiac disease, has 10 times more, so 10%. But 9 out of 10 is still chance it would not have celiac disease.
Okay, very good. So I want to talk about definitive tests. What are the, since it is so often not diagnosed and or misdiagnosed, what are some definitive tests that can prove that we do have celiac disease?
The diagnosis is a two-step process. The first is the screening test. It's a very simple blood test that looks for specific antibodies. They are present only in people with celiac disease. They are very accurate, almost precise, i.e. almost 100% precise. If you test positive, because it's almost but not 100% certain, and because this is a lifelong change in lifestyle to embrace a gluten-free diet, in order to have certainty, then the second step, if you test positive, is to do an endoscopy, i.e. to take a tube down your mouth and take a little piece of the intestine so that you can look at directly the autoimmune insult of the intestine that is typical of celiac disease.
Mm. Okay, very good. And is that the first test is just a simple blood test, I
say? Simple blood test.
Yeah, okay. I have another listener question from Martin with a Y. He's on the road 80% of the time. He does have celiac disease, finds it very difficult to eat healthfully because gluten's often in things that he doesn't know where it is. He's heard there's a vaccination that he can take to help alleviate symptoms, but his doctor said no, there isn't. Right or wrong?
The doctor is right. There is no such a thing. There are studies right now to develop alternatives, or more than alternatives, I would say synergistic treatment to the gluten-free diet. So in other words, as Martin was mentioning, the challenge to go the gluten-free diet is the cross-contamination of gluten that is pretty much everywhere. So particularly if you spend a lot of time on the road, the chance exists that you will be exposed inadvertently to small amount of gluten that harms you.
Mm.
So there are a couple of technologies out there, one developed here at University of Maryland that is already in a very advanced stage of clinical trial, to have a pill that you take before eating so that if you inadvertently will be exposed to cross-contamination, that will take care of it.
Okay.
Again, this is still in a clinical trial. And the vaccine, there is also an initiative to develop a vaccine. But, you know, this is at the very early stage, and we're talking about years, not, you know, earlier than that, to have a vaccine that may eventually be of some help with people with celiac disease. But definitely we don't have anything right now available.
Okay. So let's look at some ways to manage this disease if somebody has it. And the first and very obvious one, is, as you said, is gluten is a no-no, period. End of conversation.
That's right.
But what else can we do to manage it? Any other tips you can give to parents of children maybe who have celiac disease?
Well, first of all, I think that it's all a matter of attitude. I mean, you know, if you see this negatively, if you think that this is a deprivation, if you think that it makes you different and therefore inferior to others, of course, you know, you start with the wrong, you know, attitude. You know, the positive spin on this is that, okay, first and foremost, we all understand that being diagnosed with a chronic disease that would not leave you ever, it's always a devastating news. But if you think, say, well, where are the alternative chronic conditions that would not leave me? Other autoimmune diseases, cancer, you know, this, after all, is a condition that is threatened just with a diet. Challenging, complicated, no matter what, but it's a diet. So no side effects, no air coming down, no possible complication over time if done right, and so on and so forth.
Mm.
The other thing is, you know what? You don't need to live in a bubble because you're afraid to be contaminated. There are rules of the game. It's like, you know, learning to go biking or to go skiing. Sure, at the beginning it will be complicated. You know, you will fail, you will be frustrated, and so on and so forth. But once you understand the mechanics, you enjoy the ride. You don't think anymore how to keep equilibrium on a bike, on skis. You just go for it. And you don't even think about the mechanic when you master, you know, your capability to go with that. So the same story with a gluten-free diet. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I was to say is very healthy, actually, because you can't eat junk food or prepare food. The best way to deal with this is to prepare everything from scratch, from fresh stuff that you know what is in there. Of course, you know, that would imply that we have to take a pause in our fast lane way of living nowadays and, you know, program before that you do, you know, whatever kind of activity. You go to work, you go on vacation, and so on and so forth. It takes, you know, programming, no question about that.
Right. And there's certainly plenty of information out there about everyday gluten-free foods. You founded the Center for Celiac Research. What are some of the things that you're working on right now?
Well, you know, we have been done in this 15 years of existence so many things, and mainly, you know, our motto is always the same. The mission statement of our center is to improve the quality of life of people with celiac disease and their families. So we developed new diagnostic tools. We made sure that the awareness of the celiac disease came in the spotlight, and we were able to come up with new genetic tests, and you know, we developed this alternate treatment that I was telling you, and so on and so forth. What we're doing right now, you know, mainly after that we achieve all these goals, and again, as a collateral, the quality of gluten-free foods now is stellar compared to 15 years ago, because now there are better products, there is more variety, and so on and so forth. Right now, what we're doing are two major projects. One is the prevention. You know, we like to prevent rather than fix. That would be ideal. So we have this very large multi-center study with a branch in Europe and now a branch in the United States that is really moving along, in which we will study, you know, tools how to eventually prevent celiac disease in infants at risk for it. So let's say that, you know, the person that called before, your listener, that she mentioned she is 8 months pregnant. Mm-hmm. The key question there is that what I'm going to do when it's time to introduce gluten. There are two school of thoughts. One is say, if you delay the introduction of gluten, you can prevent celiac disease. Will give the time of the immune system to mature and so on and so forth. The other school of thought said that's not true. You just delay the onset, but, you know, the destiny is destiny. We want to understand which one of the two school of thoughts may be true. And so we are following over time kids that are born from families with members with celiac disease, and we double-blind study in which, you know, some kids will be exposed to gluten at the normal time for between 4 and 6 months of age, and some in which we postpone introduction of gluten by 6 months, so they start at a year of age.
Right, interesting.
And now we're following these kids over time.
Interesting.
That's one project. The other project is...
We're really short on time, so
okay.
we have to go. But you know what? I'm going to refer listeners to your website if they want to learn more about what you're doing, because it's really interesting stuff. And I know you are leading the way on this, Dr. Fasano, and I really appreciate you being with us today and sharing some of this information with our listeners. And your website is celiaccenter.org, correct?
That's right.
Celiaccenter.org. And you can find out more about that and Dr. Alessio Fasano. You can just Google him, F-A-S-A-N. No, Dr. Alessio Fasano, and tons of stuff will pop up about him. I thank you for being with us, and thank you for listening today. And if you have feedback on today's show, you know where to reach me, conversationslive.net or 800-495-7617. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong, and thanks for spending this hour with us on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.